It's Philosophy Talk.
Wake up, have breakfast, eat lunch, take a bath.
Does everything we do, no matter how small, express our philosophy?
Think of the things you do every day.
Brushing your teeth, talking to your parent,
shopping, driving to work,
going to the gym, preparing dinner,
falling asleep and dreaming. Can philosophy illuminate ordinary acts in an ordinary life?
Ever since I started working, every single day of my life has been worse than the day before it.
Are there philosophies of sandwich making, underwear folding, and shoe tying?
Our guest is Robert Roland Smith, author of Breakfast with Socrates, An Extraordinary Philosophical Journey Through Your Ordinary Day.
Philosophy and Everyday Life.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk, after the news. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the studios of KALW San Francisco.
Our conversations begin over on the Stanford campus at Philosopher's Corner.
Today, philosophy and everyday life.
Ken, all philosophers know that Socrates said, "The unexamined life is not worth living."
Which implies that if a life is worth living, well, then it must be worth examining.
So in this episode, we're going to take Socrates' advice to heart, and we're going to examine life, ordinary, everyday, possibly boring life, through the lens of philosophy.
So, like, let's start by considering the arc of a single day, for example, from waking up through going to work to falling asleep, maybe after a good meal or sex with your partner. What does philosophy have to teach us about the events that make up a day?
Or consider the arc of a lifetime, from birth through taking your first steps, learning to talk, having your first kiss through marriage, divorce for some of you, retirement, death for all of us. What does philosophy have to teach us about the events that make up a lifetime?
To help us answer these questions, we'll be joined by Robert Roland Smith. He's author of two books about philosophy and everyday life. His first book was Breakfast with Socrates, An Extraordinary Philosophical Journey Through Your Ordinary Day. His second is Driving with Plato, The Meaning of Life's Milestone.
You know, Ken, as I read Breakfast with Socrates, I was struck by how it seems that Robert Roland Smith and I took exactly the opposite approach to philosophy.
How do you mean that, John?
Well, I usually start with something that people find mysterious, initially find mysterious. Philosophers find mysterious. Maybe everybody finds mysterious, like personal identity or consciousness or freedom. Then I put a lot of effort into trying to show that in the end, nothing all that mysterious is going on after all.
So, for example, it seems extraordinary to some philosophers that in a world governed by relentless, inescapable causal necessity, human beings can still nonetheless act freely in violation of that causal necessity.
And that combination of causation and freedom drives some philosophers to say batty things, that if I'm going to pick up and drink from my coffee cup, then I can't not pick up and drink from my coffee cup. It leads into saying all kinds of crazy things about responsibility and freedom.
So, and sensible philosophers like you, what do you do?
Well, I try to calm down and look closely at how ordinary people make decisions and how our concepts and words work and try to filter out the bad ideas of generations of philosophers. Then I claim you can have your causation and freedom. You can have your freedom and eat your determinism, so to speak, without having to believe in anything too weird.
So that makes what at first seemed extraordinary, at least to some philosophers, fact of freedom in a deterministic world seem perfectly ordinary. Now, that's how you work. Now, how do you see what Robert Roland Smith is up to in comparison with the way you work?
Well, I want to emphasize I admire his approach, and I don't see them as inconsistent, just more complementary. But instead of starting with some highfalutin philosophical puzzle, like how you can reconcile freedom and determinism, he starts with perfectly ordinary events, like taking a bath or driving to work, and makes them philosophically alive, using insights from Socrates to start with a lot of people in between who I've never read.
Right. Consider what he says to illustrate what you mean about waking up. And that's something we do every day, and it sort of takes us by surprise because you just wake up and you're there. Here's what he says, though. predictable and unpredictable in equal measure, waking up is a paradox, a kink in the straight logic of things, which is just one of the reasons why it's worth thinking about. One of the profoundest actions we can take. The whole of philosophy, he says, is about nothing else. And from there, he launches into this really interesting and entertaining discussion of the nature of consciousness.
This very interesting author, Robert Roland Smith, is going to join us shortly to help lead us on a philosophical tour of the milestones of everyday life.
And whether your own life is ordinary or extraordinary, we want you to travel on our philosophical journey, too.
But first, our roving philosophical reporter, Caitlin Ish, talked to some women who incorporate philosophy into their everyday lives. She files this report.
It's years since I've been angry or scared, really. I can't remember when.
As a tutor at the School of Practical Philosophy in Pleasanton, California, Mariam Sefinia leads classes in wisdom and in family. She's not exactly a trained philosopher. She actually used to be an architect. Her husband, also a tutor at the school, is a retired oral surgeon.
We're just people who are interested in the big questions of life.
You may have heard of the School of Practical Philosophy. It's an international nonprofit corporation formed in London in 1937. Back then, it was known as the School of Economic Science.
So you're going to be my student now, right? So, upright and balanced and sort of sit square, you know?
These days, classes mix Eastern and Western philosophies, incorporating Advaita Vedanta, or the philosophy of non-duality, as well as Plato, Socrates, Rumi, Shakespeare, American Transcendentalism, and of course, meditation.
If you notice any tightness in your chest or stomach, just release it so that your breath can be deep and full.
Sefinia came to the school 22 years ago when she was living in London. She says before enrolling, she was miserable.
It was a time of difficulty personally. Physically, I had cancer, but I didn't know it yet. I think it was in week 4 or 5 of the philosophy that I was diagnosed with it. My daughter was going through difficult problems, and life was difficult.
She learned simple lessons that transformed her life, like how to feel calm and aware. Sefinia's students say the same thing.
It has enlarged my spectrum. It has opened my eyes to new possibilities and a deeper understanding of how things work.
It gives me a sense of stability. Becoming what I talk or what I know or what I want to do and being that and really practicing it in life.
The classes aim to increase happiness and develop perspective.
Whatever you give your attention to grows. So if you keep going back over and over to what the boss said that made you angry or so-and-so insulted you or whatever, that's going to grow.
Sefinia's students all say the same thing. It's not about changing your surroundings to fit your needs. It's about changing yourself.
You don't lose your steadiness with the turbulences of life. You know, you always have access to that, which is an inner experience, an inner certainty. It has nothing to do with what happens in the outside world.
And so everything becomes a delight. Brushing your teeth is delightful. You know, the smell of toothpaste is magical.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Caitlin Ash.
I'm John Perry. With me is Ken Taylor.
And our guest is Robert Roland Smith. He's author of Breakfast with Socrates, An Extraordinary Philosophical Journey Through Your Ordinary Day, and more recently, Driving with Plato, The Meaning of Life's Milestones. Robert, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Robert, I'm tempted to ask you how come you know so much and get so much done. But the answers would depress me, so I'm not going to ask you that.
Okay.
Instead, I'm going to ask you how you went from being an Oxford Don. Now, I don't know much about being an Oxford Don, except what I've learned from watching Inspector Morse and Inspector Lewis. Uh-huh. And so I know it's a life of dry scholarship punctuated by murderous intrigue.
Right. Now, well, that's almost exactly true about Oxford.
Okay. So how did
the murders take place in the common room, however, and they're mainly metaphorical.
But, metaphorical.
Murderous it is.
Okay. So how did you get from this murderous but dry life to your very original, readable, and basically nonviolent approach to philosophy?
Well, this is a brief relapse, of course, before the violence returns. What happened was that I decided I needed a change. I'd been teaching in Oxford for about 10 years. I moved to California, in fact, and I guess that had an impact on me because, as you know, in California, it's all very well to be an Oxford Don, but you've got to make things real and practical and apply things to everyday life. So that had an influence. And then I got a job in the real world, in the business world. And I guess after doing that for about 10 years, I wanted to try and fuse the two things together, the ivory tower and the real world. And that made me want to write books that weren't just academic, but also reached out to people. So now what I try and do is do both. So I write academic books still, but I also try to write books which are efforts at unpacking and blowing off the dust from some of those academic endeavors and making them available to people.
Well, I love your books. I gather when you're in California, you lived in L.A. because you ruminate a lot about life in L.A., driving to the gym, things like that.
Yeah, well, I mean, L.A. is so interesting. I mean, I know you're in Northern California, and people in San Francisco in particular sometimes are a little bit acerbic about SoCal, as they call it.
Yes.
But I found L.A. so interesting because, for me, it was, to some degree, a picture of the future. It's a kind of picture of modernity. And if you want a kind of predictor of what life is going to be like elsewhere, you can, in many cases, you know, look to L.A. as to what things will be like. So there is a chapter in the book, Breakfast with Socrates, about driving to the gym. And, you know, that, for me, is one of the central paradoxes of modern life. You know, we drive to the gym. The gym is all about working out, and we drive to get there, which is about the opposite of working out.
Well,
so that for me is, you know, a nice, neat little paradox about modernity.
So let's plunge into the meat of things here. Your breakfast companion, Socrates, says the unexamined life isn't worth living.
Yeah.
You seem to agree, but why not? I mean, the unexamined parts of my life have sometimes been very nice.
Yeah, so why isn't the unexamined life worth living?
Well, I think we all have maternal and paternal agendas that we're working out. And my mother always used to say to me, Robert, ignorance is bliss. Right? So I think I'm partly in reaction against her when I took up this sort of mantle of the notion of examining the everyday life. So I think it's partly that. But, I mean, I think the qualification for me is that, you know, where Socrates says the unexamined life is not worth living, what I'm trying to get at is the unexamined day. The unexamined day is not worth living. And that's because, I mean, life only takes place on days, you know. The most momentous events, you know, deaths, births, attacks, inventions, they take place on a Tuesday morning or a Thursday afternoon.
Okay, Robert, I get your focus from the life to the day, although your next book is about the life. But yeah. I get that. But still, I want to... We philosophers take it for granted that only the examined life is worth living.
Yeah.
But why must a life be examined to be worth living? That's what I want to know. Why the examining of a life? I mean, it could be fun, but suppose you examine your life and find out, oh, it's awful. There's no meaning. There's no purpose. And wouldn't you be better off just not examining it?
Yeah, well, at least you'd have some melodrama to fall back on then, wouldn't you? That would be pretty good. We call the sort of in a writhing agony of Sartrean despair, saying nothing is worth anything. But at least we get points for drama.
Well, that's true. Yeah. But okay, so is that it? Because examining, even if there's nothing there, gives you drama, makes your life more dramatic? What does examining your life do for you?
Okay, so more seriously, I think I have two answers to it. One is it does everything, and the other is it does nothing. So it does everything because if you don't examine your life, I mean, I think, A, your life is less rich because you're missing out that reflective dimension. So there's just an extra layer of interest which you can adduce to your life. And B, I think if you don't examine your life, you're vulnerable to people who can manipulate you because self-reflection is a critical faculty. And that builds your sense of awareness of what's around you, enables you to be more skeptical, and stops you being vulnerable to other people's dogma. So I think, you know, from that point of view, I completely support the idea of examining the life. But here's where I'm going to argue the opposite, because I mean, I'm a big fan of art, okay? I spend a lot of time looking at paintings and going to galleries, and I love all that stuff. And what I see when I go to galleries and so on are artists who don't necessarily examine their life and don't necessarily bring everything into consciousness, but allow the unconscious to speak. And a lot of artworks, in my view, are more reflections of unexamined unconsciousness. These are things which haven't been worked over by the analytic, rational, philosophical mind.
Well, we're going to have to put the analytic, philosophical mind to rest for just a little bit here.
Because you're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're talking about philosophy and everyday life with Robert Roland Smith, author of Breakfast with Socrates and Driving with Plato.
We're going to move from talking about the value of the examined life to actually examining some features common to many of our lives. What philosophical insights can you find in waking up, traveling to work, cooking and eating dinner, having a fight with your wife or your significant other?
Philosophy and the things we do every day, when Philosophy Talk continues.
If you're having a pretty good day, is it worth asking why? Or if you ask why, do you risk converting your pretty good day into a miserable day? At any rate, asking why, examining your life, that's the theme today. We're taking a philosophical lens to everyday life. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor, and this is Philosophy Talk. What do you think of when you're getting ready for work, going to the doctor, planning a vacation, falling asleep and dreaming? Do you have profound philosophical thoughts? You should.
Our guest is Robert Roland Smith. He's the author of Breakfast with Socrates, An Extraordinary Philosophical Journey Through Your Ordinary Day.
So, Robert, we want to focus on the ordinary day, and then our next segment will focus on a life. But in Breakfast with Socrates, you take us on this philosophical journey, you say, through an ordinary day. But I wonder something. I wonder how much it matters. You know, philosophy likes to deal in eternal verities. But I wonder how much it matters, philosophically speaking, that the day you take us on a journey through be the day in the life of a person in a 21st century industrialized democracy rather than, say, a 19th century rural peasant. Does the philosophical significance of waking up, for example, or eating breakfast or going to work depend at all on where and when you live?
Of course they do at some level, but take your example of the 19th century peasant. There he is, or she is, trekking through the fields, maybe gathering up food to sell at the market, earning a pretty hard crust. And like the 21st century commuter, on their way to work, they will be full of anticipation as to what the day will bring, and maybe not as happy as they might be. After all, work is work, right? So
right.
What I talk about in the book is the idea that on our way to work, and that's whether you're a peasant or a 21st century commuter, you're just as likely to be fantasizing about a different life, a work life that is somehow alleviated and made much better for you. So I don't know if it really changes necessarily from, you know, a kind of medieval peasant life to a 21st century life.
But that makes it sound like work, you said, no, whether you're the 19th century person or the 21st century person, work is work. And you know what that made it sound like? It made it sound like work is labor. Work is excruciating. Work is something you'd rather not be at, that your real life is someplace else.
Yeah, well, I noticed when I used to have a, you know, kind of day job and I used to commute in, I used to look at all the people on the train, on the commuter train, and what it seemed like was that people were dreaming about anything other than being on the train. You know, it looked like their faces were kind of taken up with maybe thinking about their holiday or a pay raise or the person they'd like to kiss or the house they'd like to buy or whatever it might be. There was a kind of lot of fantasy going on.
Here in America, when we commute to work by car, we dream about being in some civilized country where you can commute on a train.
Right, exactly.
So,
but still, the notion of fantasy, I think, for me, takes us back to what Nietzsche talked about. He's a German 19th century philosopher, as I'm sure you know. And he talks about the fact that this distinction between the ideal life that we'd like to lead and the real life that we actually do lead is itself a distinction that really is no good for us. And really, we need to make our real lives like the ideal. And this is his challenge to us. You know, instead of sitting there on the train or driving in the car every morning and fantasizing about the pool you'd like to be swimming in or whatever it might be, you know, act, make a difference, change your life, and overcome that difference between the real and the ideal.
So this, I think you're onto really something really important, and I think you've given us another answer implicitly about why it's important to examine your life, why only the examined life is worth living. Because in some ways, only the examined life is the life that you fully own. Because when you examine your life, you say, oh, here I am daydreaming about being someplace other than work. And then you ask yourself, why am I working? Do I do that by choice? Is it my choice? Is that just something thrust upon me? And when you put that question to yourself, you either take ownership over your life or you realize you haven't taken ownership of your life. And then this problem is thrown back on you of owning your own life through reflection. What do you think about that?
Yeah, exactly right. And, you know, think of the alternative. You're just in autopilot mode otherwise. So, I think owning your own life is absolutely critical. And that's what, you know, that's probably the thing that, that makes it worth living and stops you fantasizing. Of course, the irony is, you know, in an ideal world, nobody would have fantasies, right? You wouldn't need to. You know, an ideal world contains no fantasies.
Well, I don't know. You might think in an ideal world, your fantasies would never be interrupted by reality.
Yeah.
I want to ask you a question about what one might think of as two contrasting philosophical approaches to everyday life. One is the Socratic Robert Rowland Smith approach of examining your life through the lens of philosophy as you live it.
Yeah.
The other is what we might call the Zen approach, or maybe less pretentiously, the stop and smell of flowers approach. And it was talked about in our roving philosophical reporter's piece. And I remember my first philosophy teacher, who was a wonderful man named Robert Brown, who was very much into Zen, used to say that the essence of philosophy distilled from all his years of thinking was don't smoke a cigarette while you're urinating. And his point wasn't that smoking was dangerous, but that, you know, if you're urinating, enjoy the experience, at least experience the urination. If you're smoking, enjoy the smoking, but don't screw up your life by doing two things at the same time. Now, these seem contrasting. I don't know if they're contradictory, but they're contrasting because, you know, if you're going along smelling the roses, but at the same time you're doing philosophy and saying, well, what is smell? Is it subjective? Is it objective? Blah, 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 blah. You can't take the Zen approach. So come on. Which is better?
Yeah, well, the trouble with the Zen approach is that it's very passive, isn't it? And especially in Taoism, you know, the idea of going with the flow renders us, I think, dangerously passive. And for me, the point of philosophy is not simply to be able to smell the flower, but it's to be able to smell the flower and then think, okay, now I need to do X or Y. So for me, philosophy is a preparation for action, not a route towards contemplation.
But I actually love the way, I think your book is kind of a phenomenological, analytical kind of synthesis, because one of the things you seem to me to do a lot is just meditate on the phenomenon, like of waking up. What is waking up? What is it like to wake up? And then that gets you into deep philosophical analysis, but there is an aspect to sort of soaking in the contours of your day in your book.
Yeah, well, just I just want to follow up on what Ken says in agreement before I allow you to speak. I think your answer should have been these are more complementary, right? That you can't really follow your approach unless you really are attending to the smell of the flowers. But go ahead.
Well, I think you've got to soak in the bath before you get out of it, but you have to get out of it. In any case, there is, I think, a bit of a misconception about Zen because people think it is this entirely passive thing. But, of course, the whole point of Zen is actually to increase your alertness, increase your awareness. And meditation is a practice which is supposed to make you entirely present in the moment. So in a certain sense, these things come together and meet again. They're not actually opposites.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about philosophy and ordinary life with Robert Rowland Smith, author of Breakfast with Socrates and Driving with Plato. And Morton in Berkeley's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Morton.
Hello. I just wanted to say that the examined life can also be practiced by making a list of your five most important things you've learned in life. And I'm not pretending it's easy. It's not. And you may take a long time to whittle down. You'll end up with 20 maybe, and then 12 and so on. And my point is that I've asked all my friends to do this at various times, not frivolously, but they don't. They vehemently say no, it's just that they don't do it. Hardly anybody will ever come up with their five list.
Well, so maybe that's because they're more than five things. I mean, life is so full of lessons for you. I mean, so do you have five quick things? Give me your top one.
Well, it's more or less the Serenity Prayer idea, which I didn't know the name of when I called it Don't Cry Over Spilt Milk for years, and then I learned the Serenity Prayer.
Well, Morton, thank you for that call. Robert, you got any wisdom to impart to Morton there?
Yeah, well, I think one of the ones that would be in my top five would be, again, Nietzsche. Maybe he's on my brain today. He says the best revenge is to live well. So, in other words, if something bad happens to you, the thing really to do is not only not to dwell on it, but to move on and make your own life as great as possible. I think that's a wonderful sentiment in that.
So, Rob, I want you to illustrate something for our listeners who haven't yet read either of your two wonderful books. Give me a philosophical reflection about, I don't know, say waking up, and a philosophical reflection about the end of the day, going to sleep. I mean, how do these two things illustrate this philosophical journey through an ordinary day a little bit for me?
Yeah, well, of course, when we wake up, we come into consciousness, and when we fall asleep at the end of the day, we go into unconsciousness. So we're in the two kind of extreme states that we exhibit as human beings. And, of course, consciousness is an extraordinary thing that we have, and when we wake up, we embrace it. And consciousness is the basis of all of cognitive, rational life. You know, it's only when we're awake that we can talk, think, interact with people, and so on. And yet, that's only the tip of the iceberg, really, because when we fall asleep beneath the waterline, there's this entire dark continent of the unconscious, you know, of dreams,
right,
of, you know, the poetry of dreams, of all of those things which are still perfectly unfathomed in the concept of the human being. I think there's a parallel with our explorations of the planet there. I mean, how much do we know about the ocean compared with the land? You know, we know a great deal about the land, but we know almost nothing about the ocean depths by comparison. And there's a kind of analogy there for me between conscious life and unconscious life. And I think the oceans of unconscious life, and after all, we spend a third of our lives asleep, is, you know, kind of chronically in need of untapping and being made aware of. So I think it's an extraordinary fact that human beings are these conscious and unconscious beings, and we do both. And we might know more about consciousness, but actually unconsciousness is really the uncharted territory.
So I want to set you, like Ken, I want to set you off on a little riff from your book. I want you to tell the world's greatest doctor joke and then say something deep about it.
Well, this is based on research, you know. So a guy calls the doctor and he says, Doctor, what should I do? My friend just keeled over. I don't know what to do. The doctor says, okay, well, the first thing to do is to make sure and see if he's dead, okay? So a gunshot sounds. The man comes back to the phone and says, okay, Doc, what now? Apparently this joke is the funniest in the world because it manages to transcend linguistic and cultural differences. Like most jokes, as you know, they kind of fall flat when you tell them in a different language. But I think for me, why is that so good? I think it's actually partly to do with the rhythm of the joke, the incomprehension, you know, the mutual miscommunication between one and the other, and the terrible consequences. You know, this guy eagerly panting away like a spaniel, saying, okay, the doc says, you know, check whether he's dead. He's still alive. Okay, shoot him. Right, he's definitely dead now. Now I'll run back to the phone. I think that is genius, you know, and it says something about the eagerness to please and the authority of the doctor. Because when a doctor's around, we do what they say, right? You know, there's something about the figure of the doctor which just still, despite the fact we can Google most of our ailments on the internet, there's something about the authority of the doctor which still prevails.
Since reading your book, I've tried the joke several times, and it's always been very successful. I think something about doctors and death, I mean, two yeah. universals of the human condition. We've got email from Greg Slater, which I'll read most of. He says, for natural animals, and perhaps for pre-Homo sapiens, unexamined life is totally natural. But for us, we've become the creators of our own artificial, unnatural lives, and it's very dangerous to not go around examining them because we'll fall into kind of human-made peril. We better examine what lives we've created for ourselves. We fail to do so at our serious peril. And I want to just briefly follow up on that with a little question to you. Mostly in your books, you tell us your philosophy by illustration. You don't really spell it out. But sometimes I think there is a little philosophy that of alienation, particularly in the chapter about driving to gyms in L.A. Is that something that you're getting across in subtle ways?
Well, look, I think it's two things. I think, you know, to be a human being means two completely different things. On the one hand, it means to be born into a world where there are other people and we have family, we're connected, we all have a mother and a father, whether we know them or not. We're in the world, we're among institutions and societies and governments and cultures, so we are connected. But on the other hand, and without wanting to get too heavy about it, you know, there is a profound sense in which we are alone. There are certain experiences, going to the gym is actually one of them, which can never be shared. I mean, you can't get somebody to work out for you, right? Unfortunately, you might like to be able to pay somebody and say, hey, you know, go and do my 30-minute jog for me. You can't. Taking an exam, you know, these are things which can't be delegated, and ultimately, you know, dying and being born. There are certain things which are inalienably ours. You know, we are at some level profoundly alone, and I think this is the extraordinary fact about the human condition. You know, we are born into a world of all of these relationships and contacts, and yet some of the most important, meaningful moments of our lives are kind of indivisibly ours and ours alone.
I think take your point, and I think there's something really profound, and there's this deep tension in human life, because there's this Heideggerian Dasein. You're always born somewhere, to some family, in some place, and you know, those people that you're born to, they come at you before you have any self-consciousness, any reflection, and they try to shape you from like the ground floor. But then there's this thing that's you that has this ability to step aside, and life seems to me like a complicated balance between the being there and the owning my own and making my own. What do you think about that?
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And it's sort of mysterious, you know, the mysteriousness of being on your own. You know, what is it really to be yourself? I mean, it's a very strange thing. I mean, I think we all walk around thinking, you know, I'm at the center of my universe and I'm kind of special and my thoughts and feelings are my own. But of course, 6 or 7 billion other people are thinking exactly the same thing. I mean, it's an extraordinary fact.
And that's why the unexamined life is not worth living. Only through the examined life can you even hope to reconcile these tensions that come with the territory of being a human being. But you know what? You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about philosophy and everyday life with Robert Roland Smith, author of Breakfast with Socrates, An Extraordinary Philosophical Journey Through Your Ordinary Day.
We've been considering the arc of an ordinary day through the lens of philosophy. But in our next segment, we're gonna broaden our horizon, or something like that, and consider the arc of a lifetime, from birth through taking your first steps, learning to walk, having your first kiss, through being married for 50 years like some of us, or divorced like others of you, through retirement and death. What does philosophy have to teach us about the events that make up a lifetime?
Life as a philosophical drama. When Philosophy Talk continues.
At least once in a lifetime, at least in an examined lifetime, you should find yourself asking things like, how did I get here? I suppose a good way to do that is do as I have done and stumble into a situation where you're talking to two people who can quote Heidegger. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything. I'm John Perry.
Accept your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is Robert Roland Smith, author of Driving with Plato, The Meaning of Life's Milestones. And we've got a lineup of callers on the line. Nicole in L.A. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Nicole.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for calling all the way from L.A.
Oh, no problem.
What's your comment or question?
Well, I actually just recently graduated from college with a degree in philosophy. And so many people ask me, what would you do with that? So maybe you guys can help me out with answering what does a so-called philosopher have to offer in the real world?
Oh, well, since Robert Roland Smith is both a philosopher and a business guy and a consultant, you can tell her what philosophers have to offer in the real world, right, Robert?
Yeah, that's a great question, isn't it? In fact, I just remembered there's a company in the UK called the Philosopher's Guild, and what they do is they make little puppets of famous philosophers that work as fridge magnets, and that's pretty good business that they've done. But more seriously, I think you see, the thing about philosophy, I think, is that it gives you the ability to think. So rather than going into a job and saying, I'm a philosopher, you go in and say, look, I have all sorts of ways of thinking, which other people don't have. And I think that, for me, is the real value that a philosopher has. You have frameworks, you have concepts, you have techniques, you have models and methods. So it's not like it's not a discipline like other disciplines. It is the very material of thinking. I think that, you know, it applies to all sorts of jobs.
I think that's very good advice. I've found philosophy majors that I've kept in touch with tend to do very well. They get into companies. They don't get as much money initially as the engineers. Maybe they're mostly getting coffee for people. But their ability to get through bull poop to the real kernel of things, often their ability to conduct committee meetings, to be sensitive to the value of different ideas, really over the long run does them well. But I want to read an email that gets us into the theme of this part, the arc of a life. This fellow, whose name I've misplaced, says, I'm a carpenter. I work with some people who are not that smart and not that educated. They have lives as little examined as anyone. He's William Peterson. I just found it. is their life not worth living? Isn't that saying they would be better off dead? It's not. If it's not that, please specify what the difference is between not worth living and better off dead. Now, I'm sure we're not meaning that they're better off dead.
No.
But what do we mean, and what do we think about the unexamined life from the point of view of examining the whole life?
Yeah, well, of course, there's a difference between people who resist thinking about their life and people who haven't been given the tools to think about their life. And I imagine your emailer is thinking about the second category. So these aren't people who would necessarily wish not to think about their lives. It's just perhaps they haven't been given the opportunity to. And I think giving people the opportunity is key. In fact, I've been involved recently over here in Europe with some projects around getting philosophy taught in schools and in prisons and in places and in hospitals and mental hospitals and so on. And what you find is that there's a huge appetite actually out there for people to be able to even know what questions to ask, let alone be able to answer them. So absolutely not. The question is not, you know, are they better off dead? No, they are better off being given the tools and the teaching that enables them to ask those questions.
So, Robert, I totally agree with you. And it seems to me, that's one of the reasons I'm involved in Philosophy Talk, it seems to me is that the capacity for philosophical reflection and a philosophical education should be regarded as the birthright of any citizen. Now, it's not something that you can just automatically do. You have to be trained and taught. I think our schools owe it to and our civilization owes it to people to empower them to examine their life, to take ownership of their life. Because if we don't regard them as a person who entitled to take ownership through reflection of their own life, what are we regarding them as a machine, as governed by our needs rather than their own needs? I mean, so it's not as, I mean, people think of philosophy as something for the elites. I think of philosophy as something that every human being is entitled to engage in and be taught to engage in.
Yeah, I agree, and I'd even go further. I'd say that it's something that all human beings have to begin with and is usually suppressed.
Right,
because
I agree.
I think about, I don't know about you guys, but, you know, I have three daughters. They've all been very young at one point, and, you know, they were all philosophers at the age of three. You know what I mean? They were asking
important questions. We did a show up in Seattle on philosophy for children. We had an audience full of fourth graders. They're natural born philosophers. It has to be beaten out. I totally agree with you. But we've got another caller on the line, Marga in Oakland. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Marga.
Well, thank you, and I'm so glad to be able to talk to you. The question I had, and I'm going to stretch it out a little bit because you're on the life segment. When I was little, I was paralyzed from the neck down with polio. Mm. And a dog who just came to visit every day was able to do what people weren't. They get me to play, get me to try to reach out and grab something. And then a lifetime later in retirement, I had a very similar kind of dog, went into pediatric hospitals, and the nurses laughed. They said, "We're pretty good, but your dog gets it 100%. For getting children to stop crying, to start playing, to be able to move into a positive mode." So my question was, what am I looking at? What is empathy and consciousness and ethics in another species? Does it exist? How do we talk about it?
Oh, that's a complicated question, Marga. Thanks for the call. What do you think, Robert?
That's a great question. Thanks so much. Well, I think two things. Firstly, this prejudice that we've had for centuries that human beings are superior to animals, we need to get rid of. Because if you think of the skills that certain animals have, you know, I'm not just talking about speed on the ground or sense of smell or auditory function, but the kind of ESP that you're referring to there. You think of that set of skills, I mean, some of them are infinitely superior to anything human beings have ever been capable of. So I think that's the first point. Human beings, in a sense, still lag behind animals in terms of some of these more advanced functions, despite the prejudice we have about them. And I would imagine that in the future of philosophy over the next 100 years, that prejudice will start to reverse.
Yeah, you know, the first thing you said that I kind of disagree with. I mean, I love animals. I have a dog, you know, and but human beings are really cool creatures of evolution, and we have these really cool social structures and language, and we can do this thing of taking reflective ownership of our lives. I don't want to diminish the specialness of human beings or the specialness of a human life, because I think we're a lot different from most animals.
Well, you got to distinguish between specialness and superiority.
Well, that's true.
course, one way in which we're special is we're the only animal that seems intent on reproducing to the point that we destroy the entire ecosystem. Dogs can register and remember 2,000 smells. That's very special, too. My dog can do things that other people can't do, like get me out of bed and get me to exercise.
So what do you think? So you're more with John. I guess I'm more against you guys, but give us one last closing insight or thought here.
Okay, well, in terms of animals, I would say what's interesting is that human beings have three parts to their brain. There's a reptilian part, there's a mammalian part, as in mammal, and there's a human neocortex. And what the caller there really is just talking about in the faculty of empathy is the middle part of our brains. So philosophy, of course, is all about the advanced bit. But actually, I'd say ultimately what we need to do is not just have the advanced rational cognitive faculties, but to balance them out with those empathic, emotional parts of the brain too. I mean, we don't want a race of philosophers who are only capable of logic. We do need rounded human beings who can think and feel.
That's very deep. That's very deep, Robert. And I totally agree with you. And, you know, on that note, I'm going to thank you for joining us. It's been a really extraordinary conversation, not at all ordinary.
Thanks very much for having me.
Our guest has been Robert Roland Smith. He's author of Breakfast with Socrates, An Extraordinary Philosophical Journey Through Your Ordinary Day, and more recently, Driving with Plato, The Meaning of Life's Milestones. And this conversation continues on our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is Cogito Ergo Blago, I think, therefore I blog. And you can find out more about by visiting our very active and ever-growing Facebook page.
There's a weekly podcast of Philosophy Talk that you can get for free. Free. You go to our website, philosophytalk.org. Now we're going to check in with the winner of our conundrum contest.
Just a little while ago, we asked you, our listeners, to submit your most vexing, most bewildering problems that you thought could benefit from some philosophical advice.
We received lots of conundrums from all across the country and around the world. Ken and I selected our three finalists, and then we got a vote from you to pick the winning conundrum. Let's jump into that right now.
And we've got our winner on the line now. Sherry, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you.
Sherry, tell us where you're from and a little bit about yourself.
I am a philosophy professor at the University of Oklahoma in Norman, Oklahoma.
Norman, Oklahoma, that's a great town, great university. A little flat and hot this time of year, I suppose.
Yes, always flat, definitely hot in recent weeks.
Okay, so Sherry, tell us your conundrum, your award-winning conundrum.
Well, my conundrum has to do with the hiring of felons. I have a friend who got out of prison several months ago and tried really hard to get a job, and he would drop off his resume and he would get called back for interviews quite frequently, but as soon as it came time for him to disclose his criminal conviction, immediately the matter would drop. He wouldn't have any further contact with the employer. So my conundrum has two parts. First of all, is it just for employers to have a blanket prohibition on hiring felons? And second, in a situation where they do, is it morally acceptable for a felon to lie and to claim to have a clean record to secure legitimate employment?
Well, let me start with the second question. I think it's okay for the felon to lie if he realizes that admitting that he has a felony will mean he doesn't get the job. It's situational. Let me give you an analogy. Suppose I have a tattoo someplace that's not immediately visible unless I disrobe to an extreme extent. And I realize the employer has a ban on tattoos. And I think that may be pretty reasonable for his purposes. But what he has in mind is tattoos that are visible on arms and necks and might put off his clientele, who are maybe, I don't know, dainty ladies of an elder age or something. But my tattoo's irrelevant. It's on my butt. They're not going to see it. So I don't see anything wrong in lying in that situation. So similarly, if a felon has a blemish on his record, but he's really convinced that his felonious days are over. I mean, if you need a job, you need a job. That's my view.
Yeah, well, let's take the first part of that question. So our society has this complicated view about felons, okay, and their rights and privileges and immunities and all that stuff. Okay, but now let's ask about the employer. Right? One of the reasons, if I were an employer, one of the reasons I might have a blanket prohibition on hiring felons is because, well, I look around and I see the recidivism rate in this society, which is tremendous. I mean, one of the things our prisons are for is crime school. So you go in there, and instead of getting rehabilitated, instead of getting employable skills, you get educated into how to be a better crook. So people come out, and they go back in, then they come out, and they go back in. So if I'm the employer, it seems to me it's reasonable of me to not want to have to deal with this. Now, there might be an ex-felon who, you know, is gone straight and is going to be a good guy or a good gal and is going to do the right thing. But how do I know that? I mean, I'm kind of making decisions under uncertainty.
Well, I think that as a society, we need to do a better job of helping to manage the risk. I also do think, though, that it's reasonable to ask employers to consider moral considerations and not just economic considerations when they think about their hiring policies. When you discriminate against people in employment and you discriminate against them in housing and in myriad other ways, it eventually becomes inevitable that in one way or another they're going to have to do something to get money and to survive, and crime is often part of that.
Well, there's a bit of a paradox there, too. Now, some employers and some landlords who don't want to rent to felons or even people with more than two misdemeanors have the ability to check that, but lots of them don't. Now, there's two kinds of felons, those that got a felony conviction because they're dishonest, bad people. Well, they're going to lie to you. And then there's the felons that didn't do much of anything wrong, know they didn't do much of anything wrong, and know that it's irrelevant. They're going to lie to you. And then there's the super honest, super innocent, absolutely driven by duty ex-felons. They're the only ones that'll tell you the truth, and they're the very ones
you would want to
you'll exclude with
right.
this policy. So
you're
it's
right.
it's not a very clear policy.
But go back to John's situation of the ex-con lying when he believes it's irrelevant, and he needs, even if he believes it's relevant and he needs the job, and he does, his alternatives are go back to prison or get a job and lie. Only Kant and a few other people think there's an absolute prohibition against lying. I don't think there's an absolute prohibition against lying, especially when you're faced with a morally imperfect situation, and it's not your duty to, you know, do the absolute morally perfect thing in a morally imperfect situation. Same thing for the employer, though. I don't know that it's his duty or her duty to do the morally best thing in a morally imperfect situation. They're both faced with kind of moral imperfection.
Well, I can certainly sympathize with such an employer because I don't want to have to question this guy and find out if his felony is really relevant and then make a decision that might be wrong. But still, that's probably my duty. I have a good to offer. We're prohibited from taking certain things into account, not that people don't, like race and gender and age, but I think you have a responsibility to try, particularly since the government has failed in its responsibility to make the term felon mean much of anything. I mean, felons can be people that smoked a little dope at the wrong time.
Yeah, so the bottom line is, if you're a courageous employer, do the right thing. And if you're a felon who knows that you're going to do the right thing, don't be afraid to lie. How's that for a solution, Sherry?
Well, let's also say if you're in government, you should fight for policies that help to reintegrate felons into society, too. Let's add that on.
Okay, there you go. So there I think we're all in agreement there. Conundrum solved.
Thanks, Sherry, for sharing your prize-winning, award-winning, democratically chosen to be the most interesting conundrum with us.
Well, thank you. It was a pleasure talking with you.
Thanks to all of you who entered our conundrum contest, and also to everyone who voted on the finalists.
We're always interested in hearing about real-life problems or puzzles that philosophy can help with. Just send us an email to conundrums@philosophytalk.org.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2011.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
Our production coordinator is Devin Strolovich. Our director of research is Ben Hirsch. Leo Weiss is our webmaster.
Also thanks to Chris Hoff, Merle Kessler, Dave Millar, Corey Goldman, and Mark Stone.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from the Templeton Foundation and from various groups at Stanford University, the Friends of Philosophy Talk,
and the members of KALW San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.